Our first poet tonight is Joseph Millar. Joseph Millar grew up in Pennsylvania and spent the last 25 years in the San Francisco Bay Area working at a variety of jobs, from telephone installation foreman to commercial fisherman. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Levine says of Overtime, now in its second printing from Eastern Washington University, "If you want the real news of how America lives, Joseph Millar is your poet." And it's true. Millar writes hard-nosed but soft-hearted working-class poems, and though the poems in the aptly titled Overtime focus with an unflinching journalist's eye for detail on the subject of work, Millar makes it look effortless, graceful, and refreshingly natural. As Barry Lopez righteously blurbs, "No intellectual wink mars the poems, no one is pilloried, nothing manufactured. The forgiveness in this voice makes us feel brave." The end of the poem, "Telephone Repairman," captures it for me. When he finishes, the messages will flow along the line. "Thank you for the gift. Please come to the baptism. The bill is now past due." Voices that flicker and gleam back and forth across the tracer-colored wires. We live so much of our lives without telling anyone, going out before dawn, working all day by ourselves, shaking our heads in silence at the news on the radio. He thinks of the many signals flying in the air around him, the syllables fluttering, saying, "Please love me," from continent to continent, over the curve of the earth. Here is a poet wizened by hard knocks, hard luck, and hard living, but whose childlike, unconditional love for the world never lags, never quits, and even works overtime. Joseph Millar is a recipient of a 2003 National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship in Poetry, grants from the Marin Arts Council and Oregon Literary Arts, and prizes from the Writers Union Competition, judged by Philip Levine, and the Jacaranda Award for Poetry, judged by Carolyn Forche. I think I got most of the biggies in there, didn't I? Recent poems have appeared in Plowshares, Prairie Schooner, Shenandoah, Tri-Quarterly, New Letters, Alaska Quarter Review, Double Take, and of course, River Styx. And not only is he a hella good poet, he's a hella good guy. Please give it up for Joseph Millar.
That was a hella good introduction. It's a great honor to come here to St. Louis and read in this distinguished historical series. And last night in the park, we saw a cardinal. I said, "A St. Louis cardinal." I'd like to read a couple poems from my book, Overtime, for sale, and then some new poems, if that's okay with you guys. That's what I'll do. I have poems in this book about work, as Richard says, and then I have poems in this book about family. And then I have some love poems. And this is a poem about single fatherhood, which is a condition that I endured for several years before I got married to my dear wife. And when you're, as some of you may know, if you're a single father, you or a single parent, and you have a child, you tend to like become more partners with that child than you would be, you know, if you were still married, because it's just the two of you and you got to compromise with them and deal with them. And this is kind of a poem about that. It's called Sole Custody. Today he'll ride his bike to Safeway in his death's head earring and mismatched socks, where the checkers all know his name. He'll buy Cheetos and Kool-Aid before coming home to bathe in the rusty light from the TV, until I get off work and collapse on the fake velvet sofa, a double order of fast food bleeding grease through a bag in my fist. He hasn't eaten anything green in a week, and I see the dirt under his fingernail when he points to the surfboard he drew on his sneaker. What would we do if I got fired, I wonder, listening to the wind outside and the evening's lead story announcing more layoffs in the South Bay? There's enough in the bank for his school clothes and the rent's almost paid again. I should be happier. He's been watching the talk shows. Have you ever done it with someone you didn't love, he asks. His old guitar resting against the wall like an abandoned girlfriend, and the pleats of the houndstooth flea market slacks gathered around his small waist like the leaves of a sunflower calyx. Eat slowly, I say, as he smiles at me around a mouthful of fries, points the clicker at my chest, and says, I'm getting fat. We're bound together like sailors, swaying across a dark ocean, resigned to each other's odd humors, and unable to see the stars overhead as we stagger around in the engine room of a ship with a foreign name. This is another poem about family. It's called Family Therapy. My brother's brown eyes narrow when I tell him about the money I stole to pay Christmas bills, the lies I told the IRS, and the bursts of cruelty to my son, how close I came last week to picking up a drink. He slides the 5/8 box wrench from its case and leans under the hood, tells me to pry up against the alternator. This belt's too loose, he says. An evening breeze rustles down the pavement as my niece comes out of the house, long hair draped beside her face, and leans against the fender. Go back inside, he tells her. Bring us a Coke. Then he turns on me. Fuck the government, he says. Do you want to starve? He swipes at the grease on his forehead, and the big knuckle on his right hand bleeds down onto the wheel well. Back off some on that pry bar, or we'll break this goddamn thing. The pale fists of the hydrangea bump against the fence, and a light comes on in the kitchen, its glow sifting onto the driveway as his wife opens the screen. Everybody yells at their kids, he says quietly, tightening the bottom bolt. Get in and start it up. We need to go for a ride. I wrote this poem about, I wrote a poem for John Keats, the poet that wrote in the early part of the 1800s. His greatest poems were written over about a three-week period, like I think in like 1821 or 1822 or something. And, you know, he never went to college, this guy. He learned everything from reading other people's books. He died when he's 26. He's like a genius, you know. He's like the great saxophone player Charlie Parker, or like Jimi Hendrix, or like somebody like that. Just gifted, completely. Or Clifford Brown, gifted, you know, and gone at an early age, and no telling what he would have written. He wrote these five great odes, you know, ode on aggression earned, ode to indolence, ode to autumn, ode to melancholy, ode to psyche, in 3.5 weeks. It's an unbelievable achievement. And he had this thing called, like he called it like negative capability. But it was where you'd be willing to live in a way that you wouldn't know what was going to happen, which is how a lot of us has to live, a lot, right? You know? But like Keats thought that like if you were a poet, that that was important to be able to live like that and to, you know, not have, he said that not seek after, reach irritably after the fact of what's going to happen. You know, emphasis on the irritably, be irritable. He said, you know, if you could, so this poem quotes that a little bit and talks about Keats. His mother died when he was like 14 and he was in the school, boarding school, and his father was already dead. And him and his two brothers were kind of abandoned on life, left. They had a little bit of money, but the guy that took care of the money was ripping them off. And he didn't want Keats was supposed to go study to be a surgeon. Well, like a surgeon wasn't like we're thinking of a surgeon. It was like a paramedic or like a corpsman in the military. You know, a guy that would go on the battlefield and bind up wounds and, you know, just like that kind of medicine. And he tried to do it for a year, and then he said, no, I want to write. He's about 19. And he had 7 years or something in which he created this great bunch of work. And so I wrote this poem, Keats' Shadow. I could be in Hampstead, I'm thinking, instead of this Oregon hayfield, with my collar turned up in the front seat, the river passing almost in secret behind dim veils of spring rain. The life of Keats, I've been too overcome to continue, lies open on the dash. Its 14-year-old grieving his mother's death has crept behind the teacher's desk to hide, and I can see a blue heron standing hunched and solitary near the blackberry canes keeping watch. Keats doesn't have much time. In 4 years, he'll be a grown man, a poet without prospects in the savage world, except for the bright flame of his fellowship, an apothecary's license, and his pen. He can write at the foot of a staircase, at a side table in someone's parlor, or in the garden of a strange hotel, reading Shakespeare and Milton, the ocean wild tearing away at the land. Oddly lit stars pulse through his nights like fireflies on the brim of an old hat, while he reinvents the sonnet and the ode, and the jackals of poverty and death fold their paws and settle down to wait. He learned to live gracefully under their gaze, without reaching irritably after fact, while Wordsworth pretended to ignore him and his brother wasted slowly away. Keats knew the blossoms that come riding out once the sap starts to rise in the tree. He knew how the tall grass darkens and bends, how the heron croaks through the April rain, and nobody tells what things mean. Thank you. So I brought a couple new poems. One is in the same sort of elegiac mode is a poem that I wrote last year when it was before Ray Charles died, but I was in the supermarket and I saw this picture of him on the Globe tabloid, you know, that said he was dying, and I came home and wrote this poem, and there's a reference at the beginning of it to a poem by Frank O'Hara, which he wrote for The Day Lady Died. He wrote this poem for Billie Holiday, in which he talks about going into all these little shops and buying various kind of European type of stuff, you know, French cigarettes and stuff like that. And so I kind of like do a little thing on that in this poem. The poem's called Georgia on My Mind. Like a low-rent version of Frank O'Hara, I'm stranded here at the checkout stand when I see the headline, Ray Charles is dying. Though I'm not buying French cigarettes or cigars or a bottle of Strega, whatever that is. No flower stalls or Mediterranean kiosks line the streets of this dim neighborhood. Only a 24-hour Albertsons, where I wait more alone than before with my lunch meat and discount cereal, my peanuts and Diet Coke. He looks wasted, yellow, eaten away, draped in a silver gabardine suit, the angel of death leaning over him. Alien trapped in a Kansas silo on the cover of the tabloid Globe. America's night-bound genius musician who kicked heroin in 65, drinking coffee with sugar and Bowles gin, who played organ, piano, alto sax, and could write a complete orchestral arrangement, each tempo and chord change, each single note entirely in his head. The world's greatest male jazz singer. I'm sorry, Joe Williams, who died on the sidewalk after walking away from a Vegas hospital, and Mel Torme with dimes on your eyes in a Los Angeles funeral home. Angel, my hands are dirty too, but I don't want to die alone like this, with my breath of old torch songs, forgotten blues. Cry me a river, lose in hand. Other arms reach out to me in a hotel near the train station, watching the rain come down. Okay, and I got one other new one here, and then one other new one I'll read you. This one's called Throne. It's about fixing a toilet. And my plumbing jobs, you know, usually you'd think I would learn, you know. You'd think I would learn by now, but, you know, this was my my most recent attempt. Throne. The toilet was ancient and wouldn't stop running, even after the stained tank filled, its metal valves and rusty ball float oxidized down to an undersea green. The new bowl was elongated, even svelte, if such a thing were possible. 85 pounds of gleaming porcelain muscled up the narrow back stairs, three separate gouges into the sheetrock, where I'd staggered and almost dropped it, knocking apart the slight shelving, scattering unguents and tubes of salve. It's a little bit about sharing a bathroom with a woman, right? Soaps made from camphor or apricot, mercurochrome and petroleum jelly, stoppered rose water, small bits of beach glass, keepsakes from some seaside interlude, aloe vera and bluing, a yellow tin of Egyptian henna, hairpins folded in rice paper. One enters this kingdom like a guest. careful to remain in one's own scant preserve, razor, toothbrush, and ragged towel kept apart from these occult potions, the jar of chalky pink fluid for the bowels, foot plasters, corn and bunion removers, gels and lotions, aspirin bottles, stockings draped casually over the shower head like dark mesh for straining opium, lavender powders, shark oil suppositories wrapped in crinkly foil. What hubris to imagine a smooth installation. I managed to donkey the new commode straight down onto its wax ring seal, black sleeve wedged in the drain pipe, its 3-inch trapway 100% glazed white vitreous china, and fastened it there with solid brass flange bolts. And I never felt the small collision against my heel in the half step I'd taken backward to admire my labor, knocking the tank from its resting place, so it fell over the threshold and broke with a sound like a glacier calving somewhere off the Siberian coast. I stayed on my knees a long time after that, trying to imagine some supplication to the gods of water and household calm, which might restore my original vision, to be seated in silence here at last, lost in thought or meditating on the perfectibility of man, idly perusing a seed catalog, or Wordsworth's poems, or the diagram of a vagina as it appears on a box of tampons. All the while basking in gratitude for the roughage in last night's salad. Thank you. You give poetry a bad name when you do that. Like somebody might have finally talked somebody to come to a poetry reading, you know, and they get there to the poetry reading, and then the person gets up there and they go on and on and on. And the guy that was the guest, he's like, I'm never going to one of those again. You know, so I always try to read a little bit less than longer, but I'm happy to read another one or two. That'd be maybe something like that, okay? That was Throne. These are like new poems, right? Sort of new poems. Here's a, let's see. Oh yeah, here's a poem I wrote. Like I was trying to kind of write like a, I was kind of trying to do a W.S. Merwin type of deal. Well, I don't know if I don't think I exactly got it, but you know. It's called Memory. Yes, I would go back there again, to climb the big rock in the pasture and watch the gray sea lions pass near the lighthouse, sighing and groaning, the brown fields of kelp, plumes of jellyfish sinking and rising above them. I'd hide from my brothers out of the wind, under the bent, ragged apple trees, breathing the vapors risen from low tide, pale skeins of salt, drying out in the sand. I'd throw stones at the stop sign over the parking lot and pretend I was dangerously lost. I would go back there to remember the small wren making its wounded sounds in the hyacinth leaves and the smell of fresh tuna cooking next door, evening turning the cove dark as wine and the narrow moon like a knife blade. But I'd be gone, I'd be long gone down the road before winter came tearing along the coast its deep snow banks hedging the stiffened beach and the surf's petals falling like broken glass onto the frozen shore. I'd be gone far away into the west and the shadows of vain gestured pride before the passing years could unbind the aging flesh of my father, before I'd forget what I came for. August's half-light stippling the grass, the black dog of time running back to me. I got this one other one, I got this one other one about coming home. You know, these ones about coming home, it kind of, I haven't been home in a long time, you know, and I went back to, I went back there and I got these poems, but they weren't that cheerful, but, you know, what are you going to do? Take what they're giving him, right? So this one's called Coming Home. I'm 50 miles west of town, a stranger driving this coal dust valley. Bottom land chopped out years ago, old snow sliding into the river. Under my shirt, my heart attack pills rattle like seeds in a gourd. Something I did a long time ago is making me feel ashamed. My father's ashes drift in the ocean 500 miles away, and no one knows who I am anymore, but I'm still afraid to look at the woman scattering rock salt over the road. Maybe I married too many times. Bunch grass stabs its glittering arrows up through the frozen gravel. I can remember holidays like repeat episodes of schizophrenia, furniture breaking downstairs in the dark, everyone's heads bowed like hostages over the evening meal. Nobody tried to get away. I've loved all the Sicilian gangsters, Genovese, Luciano, the films of Scorsese and Francis Coppola, turf wars passing from father to son, where the family's blood washes clean every crime. Men my age didn't dream of new love, numbers runners and hitmen, blessed by the glass Madonna, a child skipping rope by the funeral home. Forgive me my transparent history. I want to say to these scarred, broken hills, it feels like it happened to someone else. Forgive me my bodiless, vagrant stare, shy footsteps roaming the prodigal dusk. Forgive the stripped, rusted threads of my voice, my ghost's hands bringing you nothing, my heart filled with cobwebs and rain.
Thanks for doing the encore.